Thanks, Barbara. It's great to be here. And it is, I think, in a way, fitting that the closing session is a presentation, given the context here at Union University by Southern Baptist. The first session closed with a presentation by a Southern Baptist, my good friend Russell D. Moore. But I have a word to you, Russell Moore, wherever you are. I have two very good reasons for proclaiming the fact that I am a better Southern Baptist than he is. Reason number one, a good Southern Baptist stays all the way to the end of the last verse of Just As I Am. And as soon as this presentation is over, I will make my way over to the chapel where Dr. George will be giving the altar call at this conference. And so I'm looking forward to staying all the way to the end. The other reason why I am a better Southern Baptist than my good friend Russell D. Moore is that only a true Southern Baptist has the courage to wear a white suit. What I would like to do today is we've had a wonderful conference dealing with a whole range of wonderful issues. And I agree with Justin Barnard, who characterized the conference by calling it the Super Bowl of Reason. And so really what I'm going to do today is sort of like an after party for the young people after the Super Bowl of Reason. I'm not going to give a paper that is from the resources of analytic philosophy. But what I would like to do is speak to my students. I'm teaching a class right now in theology of culture, and I would like to describe something about the mood that younger evangelicals currently find themselves in, the challenges that we face as we look toward the future, and what some of the challenges are that we can face and how we might collaborate, even with folks that we disagree across the denominational and faith spectrum, on these issues of how natural law and Christian witness might be composed, and how we might effectively reach the culture with the gospel message in, as we heard last night, increasingly adverse conditions. So I would like to begin by referencing a now infamous interview that Irving Kristol gave in 1981 to the New York Times. He was asked what a neoconservative was. And his definition, I have always loved this, a neoconservative is a liberal who has been mugged by reality. So if you're a well-heeled liberal and you're walking through Central Park and you think that all is right with the world and that can't we all just get along and just give peace a chance, and then someone sticks a, you know, 38 special into your ribs and says this is a stick-up, you might change your view on human nature, for example. So I wanted to give a similar kind of definition for what it means to be a younger evangelical in our context. And I would define a young evangelical in the following way. A young evangelical is a Christian who's been mugged by the sudden realization that you are a social leper because you affiliate with a certain religious demographic. And I could stay here for the rest of our time today and talk about all of the different publications that are coming out of evangelical presses that are consumed with this worry of our standing as a generation with the broader culture at large. Here is one of them. It is a book that's published by the Barna Group. It's not by George Barna, it's by one of his younger associates named David Kinnaman. It's called Unchristian, and it is 251 pages of abject worrying that nobody likes us anymore. So how do we face that kind of environment in which we find ourselves? And so what I would like to do for my students here, this will be a well-worn tale for some of you in the room, but for others, I would like to explain how we got to this point. And what I want to suggest is that the process of secularization is not something that has been downstream from a reaction to what some younger evangelicals think are, you know, poorly guided efforts by icky people like, you know, the late Jerry Falwell or Pat Robertson, and this is why no one likes us anymore. Rather, we have been mugged by the Enlightenment. And I would like to talk about actually why there are very, very good reasons for people to hold their secular opinions, and then how the church might recover. In his 1887 notebook entry on European nihilism, Friedrich Nietzsche looked forward to what he saw was his preferred future for the continent. And in his list of anti-virtues, he celebrated the idea that there are no final goals to existence. He repudiated the notion that every human being has infinite value, and he relished the idea of the extinction of spiritual consolation. The strongest persons, according to Nietzsche, in this dawning age of nihilism, are those who have, quote, no need of extreme dogmas, those who not only concede but love a good measure of chance and nonsense, unquote. And he concluded that entry in his notebook with the following concept that I think summarizes the mood of the world in which we live. God is much too extreme a hypothesis. Now, despite attempts to kill the deity off, the project to end religion in the West has been a rather miserable failure. Even such a dedicated nihilist as Michel Foucault, in the final sentence of his book on the archaeology of knowledge, says, "You may have killed off God beneath the weight of all that you have said, but don't imagine that with all that you are saying, you will make a man who can live longer than he." So we face a time in which there is an important difference between institutionalized religion and the urge to continue on with the project of transcendence and to think about transcendent categories and to be spiritual persons ourselves. And this is the thing, this is the central conundrum or puzzle that younger evangelicals are trying to figure out. And I'm speaking specifically of my students, my group of people. This is who I'm primarily interested in talking to, and I'm sure we could have our colleagues from other faith traditions talk about how their young people react to these things. But this is an issue of central importance for us, because as Goethe once said, the fate of any nation at any given time depends upon the opinions of its young men under 25. So how did we get to this place of the declining fortunes of institutional Christianity? Why was the Christian religion abandoned in the first place by the leading intellectuals and cultural elites on the European continent? How did we get to this point of secularization? Secularization is, of course, as Peter Berger defined it, the removal of dominant symbols of religion and religious institutions from the public sphere. And while the reaction against traditional religion is part of the story, the plausibility of secularism has deep roots that go beyond what Bill O'Reilly talks about on the O'Reilly Factor every Christmas when somebody fails to put up a creche or a menorah in a public space. Secularization is far more than that. It has its roots in 17th and 18th century Europe, and even before then. The first event worth mentioning in this connection involves Savonarola's attempt at reform in late 15th century Florence. Denouncing the corruption and worldliness of the church, the Dominican friar called for a political revolution based upon moral and spiritual reform. He condemned the art, culture, literature, and music that flourished during the time of Lorenzo the Magnificent. Savonarola would have made a very good evangelical in our contemporary context, because when evangelical leaders today talk about cultural engagement, what they really mean is cultural critique. They just talk about why the culture is going to hell in a handbasket, and ain't it sad, ain't it bad, and ain't we all depressed about it. And that's what goes for cultural engagement. And in fact, that is what Savonarola did. In his now infamous Bonfire of the Vanities, Savonarola sought to purify the church by banning, destroying, and or burning Renaissance art, secular books, game tables, chess tables, and literary texts related to humanist thought. So the record burnings that you guys went to in high school, of all get rid of all your rock and roll music, somewhere back there Savonarola is smiling. But upon the death of Lorenzo, Savonarola formed a political party that he inspired, and he rose to power, and he repudiated contemporary Italian culture in a radical attempt to address and achieve national holiness. And his requirements for morality were harsh, but they justified their actions by saying that what they were trying to build was a Christian nation. But Savonarola's preaching failed to ultimately rally people to his cause. He was condemned by Rome for aggregating prophetic powers to himself that were not conferred upon him by the church, and he was eventually burned at the stake by Alexander VI. And it was Niccolo Machiavelli that took special note of Savonarola's inability to reform Italy both morally and politically. For the author of The Prince, attempts to change culture by appealing to holiness and right living paled in comparison to the more persuasive method of a quartered army. Quote, "If Moses, Cyrus, Theseus, and Romulus had had no weapons, they could have never imposed their institutions on their peoples for so long. In our own times," Machiavelli averred, "there is the example of Father Girolamo Savonarola, who collapsed with all of his new ordinances as soon as people ceased to believe in him. He had no way of keeping the backsliders in line or of converting the doubters." What mattered for the prince, Machiavelli ultimately concluded, was not religious zeal, but the power to enforce one's will upon others. And as a result, those in Machiavelli's train view the church as gravitating to either one of two extremes. Either it's harshly moralistic, or it is corrupt. In either case, the law of parsimony draws the church out of the circle when it comes to governance and prefers the more persuasive method of the sword. And this point of view increasingly came to be known as realism. And so in the 16th and 17th centuries, you had a series of unmitigated disasters for the church on the European continent. The French Wars of Religion, with its mix of Protestant and Catholic theological intrigue, proved that arguments over doctrine proved to be very dangerous public policy. Even at the level of popular culture, St. Bartholomew's Day Massacre still lives on in infamy, in which a bloodbath ensued when there was an assassination attempt on the Huguenot leader Gaspard de Coligny's life, and 50,000 people were slain in the streets of Paris in just the period of a couple of weeks. And the city of Paris, in the month of August 1572, devolved into anarchy. In Germany, in the wake of the Protestant Reformation, Martin Luther himself had some difficulty trying to explain how we could be free from the dictates of the papacy when it comes to matters of faith, but still beholden to the princes when it comes to the matter of civil disobedience. And so to explain the paradox, Luther penned his essay entitled On Temporal Authority and the Extent to Which It Should Be Obeyed. And here, Luther famously proposed his two kingdoms view. The church, he argues, knows no law but the love of the gospel as the people of God. It is the colony of heaven that temporarily resides here on earth. The other kingdom belongs to secular rulers. And arguing from the book of Romans, chapter 13, the reformer claimed that earthly government is the purview of sinners, not saints. Still, God uses the sword of the state to keep law and order and instill terror on those who do evil. But these two kingdoms can never be put back together after the Reformation, Luther said. They are, at least in this world, separate. And so with this two kingdoms model, Luther unhinged the project of how religion and culture can be put together and introduced a terrible conundrum into Western thought. Although the Reformation accelerated the dissolution of the medieval synthesis between church and state and opened up the possibility for religious freedom, Luther simultaneously and quite unwittingly sowed the seeds for the demise of religion's role as a source of cultural authority. And so on the heels of the Protestant Reformation, actually in juxtaposition to Luther's claims in, on temporal authority, Germany itself experienced a terrible convulsion in the 30 Years' War that further besmirched the reputation of religion's involvement in matters of the state. The war scarred the German population. Mercenary armies were set loose upon the population. And if you look at the graphic here, if you look at the red represents population or provinces in the German Republic at that time that in which there were over 50% population loss. The purple represents 41 to 50% population loss. Now, clearly, during the wars of religion, Christianity had become terribly distorted from the time of the witness of the early Christians, from a day in which the church had gained social capital by their behavior in public life. But is it any wonder, in the light of these experiences, why the cultural elite of Europe would want to revisit Christianity as the central narrative that defines European culture? We could understand why they would want to give it up. So when Voltaire criticized the all-too-Pollyannish worldview that God's sovereign and he's working out everything for the greater good against that backdrop, you could understand his dictum, écraser l'enfant, crush religious superstition. And when Immanuel Kant said, sapere aude, have courage to use your own reason, this is the motto of enlightenment, we can see the reason for this declaration of independence from the dictates of the clergy and the theologians. Now, in the English-speaking world, no philosopher levied a more trenchant critique of theology's role in forming government than did Hobbes. Oh, not that one. Thomas Hobbes' worldview took shape in light of the English Civil Wars, which once again were largely religious in nature. He feared Catholicism's unification of the church and state on the one hand, because it centralized power, but he also feared the Protestant project and its doctrine of the priesthood of the believer, which he felt if you took priesthood of the believer seriously, a culture would devolve into anarchy. And so for this reason, the author of The Leviathan sought to remove political questions from the arena of theological debate and turn them into a science of common sense and natural justice. And so political science, as we know it, was born. As Columbia University professor Mark Lila sums up Hobbes' contribution in his book that you should all read, The Stillborn God, Religion, Politics, and the Modern West, much of which I disagree with, but I think this is spot on. Before Hobbes, those who sought to refute political theology kept finding themselves driven deeper into it as they tried to solve the many puzzles of God, man, and the world. Hobbes showed the way out by doing something ingenious. He changed the subject. The aim of Leviathan is to attack and destroy the entire tradition of political theology, what Hobbes called the kingdom of darkness. Yet the treatise begins not with theology or politics, God or kings, but with physiology. Specifically, it begins with an exploration of the human eye and how it perceives the world. On the very first page of his work, Hobbes makes an implicit profession of faith that to understand religion and politics, we need not understand anything about God. We only need to understand man as we find him, a body alone in the world. Now, Hobbes' dream to relegate the study of politics just to the brute realities of man's existence, known through the vehicle of modern science, however, left the human being incredibly vulnerable to any ideology predicated on the idea of scientism. So by giving up on the idea of political theology, Hobbes opens up a world of mass brutality. And so by the end of the 20th century, the estimates for the number of innocents killed under the auspices of secular regimes, of totalitarian regimes, often anti-Christian and anti-religious regimes, total somewhere between 100 to 200 million persons. So all of the wars of religion are just infinitesimal in scope compared to what happens under secular contexts. The First and Second World Wars, Mao's revolution, Stalin slaughtered the innocents in the killing fields of Cambodia were not conflicts fought upon religious grounds. In his 1970 T.S. Eliot Memorial Lectures, George Steiner talked about the fact that Voltaire had predicted the end of mass brutality from authoritarian rulers and despots once the demise of religion was complete in the public square. But Steiner says Voltaire could not have been more wrong. On the contrary, indifference on the subject of religion breeds intolerance. And he said this, the epilogue to belief, the passage of religious belief into hollow convention seems to be a more dangerous process than the philosophes anticipated. And so Steiner says that instead of having a doctrine of literal hell to which the baddies go when they die to get their just recompense for their works done in the body, modern secular ideology simply relocates hell above ground. And we've been dealing with hell above ground ever since. And it is for that reason that postmodernism makes sense. You know, sometimes, I'll just speak for the evangelical community, we do a horrible job of explaining what postmodernism is and why it makes sense to this generation of people. Postmodernism is a protest against these kinds of totalizing ideologies that crushed the religious spirit and crushed human beings, what Jean-Francois Lyotard called crimes against humanity. That is fundamentally what postmodernism is about. But typically the way we narrate postmodernism, at least in the evangelical world, is, I was asked to come speak on this at another Christian university recently. I was supposed to do a series of lectures on postmodernism, and I stood up, and this was the lecture that I started off with. I stood up at the podium, and I said, postmodernism, boo! And then I went and sat down and just sat there for, about a minute while that sunk in, because that's typically all that we get about postmodernism. But it's more than that. It's a protest against human beings who are being oppressed by these kinds of totalitarian ideologies. Now, unfortunately, once you release that sort of virus into the system of Western thought, everything is subject to that, whether it be the Communist Manifesto, Mein Kampf, or the Bible. And so we live in a world now in which deconstruction takes place, and it is going to continue to take place. So whenever you arrive at a moral maxim that you think is universally verifiable to everyone, our generation is going to try to find a way to deconstruct that and figure out what's wrong with it. So as John Caputo has put it, whenever deconstruction finds a nutshell, a secure axiom or pithy maxim, the very idea is to crack it open and to disturb this tranquility. And yet, in light of the demise of institutional religion, postmodernism gives rise to this romantic kind of desire to re-engage with these great themes of transcendence and hope and metaphysical possibilities. I was reminded of this a couple of years ago when I was listening to National Public Radio host Renee Montaigne interview David Bowie, and she was talking to him about his new album. She said, "You know, I'm really struck by this new album because everything in your catalog up until this point has been from the standpoint of nihilism. But here you're talking about God, and you're talking about transcendence, and you're talking about hope. What's going on?" And Bowie referenced, he was 55 years old at that point, and was actually just now, this is the rock and roll lifestyle, he was just then beginning a family. And he referenced his young family, and he said, "You know, I have to write from a position of hope and transcendence now, because I have a 2-year-old. And I thought, that's right. It's pretty hard being a nihilist with a 2-year-old running around the house. So here we are. We're in a culture in which people want to re-engage with transcendence, but they're very critical and suspicious about religious institutions. So what do we do? Do we just take up with the postmodern mood and persist in that kind of hopefulness without ever connecting the dots? Well, I fear we can't do that. Because as Kierkegaard once said so poignantly, he who marries the spirit of the age will be a widower in the next. So, what do we do? What do we do with the fact that we have transcendence without institutional religion, and every time you say something that's rational and everybody says, wow, that's right, that makes sense, but how can we deconstruct it? Where do we go from here? Well, we have to hope at the end of this conference for a rapprochement between natural law approaches to cultural change and theologies of revelation. We have to hope for that. And let me just say, this may sound strange for some of you in this room, but those of us that have studied this know these two groups don't really get along so great. Theologies of revelation and natural law. We've heard some of those tensions coming up already in this conference, and I have to admit, let me make a confession here, okay, which I know is a dangerous thing for a Baptist to do amidst a sea of Roman Catholic colleagues. But I myself have been something of a skeptic when it comes to the natural law approach, when it comes to affecting cultural change. I'll go ahead and say it. And I am so because of this guy, my mentor, Carl F. H. Henry, who just did not see any way that natural law and the Christian understanding of revelation could be composed. And Carl Henry never changed on this. You can read essays that he wrote in Christianity Today in 1957 called Natural Law and Revelation, and he said, pure reason alone leads to Stalin and Mao, and they think that they're rational in doing so. The only hope is for a fully orbed Christian world and life view, which is something that he articulated in The Uneasy Conscience of Modern Fundamentalism. He called upon the church to bring all of the resources of Christian revelation to bear upon every sphere of life. Here's a quote from an article that he wrote toward the end of his life in First Things called Natural Law and a Nihilistic Culture. He said, natural law cannot turn the tide in a culture of nihilism. Christianity, he says, offers no speculative theory of ethics that renders certain courses of action personally and socially obligatory. The existence and priority of God, known in his revelation, is its basic affirmation. Speculative views may consider the existence or non-existence of God irrelevant to ethical concerns, but for evangelical Christianity, the content of morality turns on divine revelation and the Bible. One reason Protestant orthodoxy in the past has not devoted itself extensively to speculative morality is that it does not derive the essential content of ethics from philosophical reasoning, but from rational revelation. This need not denigrate moral reflection, but it precludes the derivation of the content of ethics from natural law no less than from the tradition or evolutionary conjecture. By the way, I once heard Millard Erickson said, I love Carl Henry. I hope someday he's translated into English. The integrity of Christian ethics requires an affirmation of God and his revelation and not simply shared values in the public order and deeper stress upon the common good. Now, I make that confession because Carl Henry was my mentor in his last few years of his sojourn on planet Earth. Now, let me be clear. I certainly have no problems with the definition of natural law that have been stated by no less than the one whom we're honoring in this conference, Dr. George, who wrote in First Things. And I don't know that we've defined natural law yet in this conference. We've talked about it, but here was a definition that Dr. George gave. Natural law is nothing other than a doctrine of public reasons that would command a universal consensus under ideal conditions of discourse, and meanwhile are available to and could be accepted by anyone who is willing and able to give them fair and adequate attention. These reasons, embraced and proclaimed by the Catholic Church, can be and have been affirmed by people who know nothing of and do not accept Jewish or Christian revelation or the authority of the Church or any other institution. Respect for these reasons as reasons accounts for the honored place of dialectic in the tradition of natural law theory, and emphasis on contemporary natural law theorists on full and fair debate in forums of democracy on issues such as abortion, euthanasia, embryonic stem cell research, human cloning, and marriage. So, having said that, I want to raise a point of discussion, and maybe this could be a springboard for our next conference. I hope there will be a next conference on these things. I want to raise some of my questions about the cultural efficacy of natural law to stem the tide in the culture in which we live. We could certainly begin with something like what Carl Henry was talking about. We've had a debate in this conference about whether or not the concept of the good can be decoupled from its rooting in a theological axiom. Well, for someone who adheres to the primacy of biblical revelation, you just cannot decouple those things. Proverbs chapter 8, wisdom speaking in the first person. I, wisdom, live with prudence. I attain knowledge and foresight. I am understanding. Courage is mine. But note, wisdom, reason. The Lord created me at the beginning of his course, as the first works of his old. In the distant past, I was fashioned at the beginning, at the origin of the earth. You cannot decouple, in Hebrew Christian thought, the concept of the good from its theological moorings. And not that everyone would want to do so, but certainly you have friendly dissenters that ask poignant questions about natural law. You have, of course, Karl Barth with his nine. You have Leo Strauss, who did not think that natural law could be decoupled from theological affirmations, and you've got, you know, Stanley Hauerwas just always continuing to be a bad boy, but always raising these kinds of questions of natural law, as he did in his Gifford lectures, with the grain, now published under the title, With the Grain of the Universe. So you have friendly dissent asking these kinds of questions. Then you've got, you know, I'm an outsider to the Natural Law Project for reasons that I just explained. And sometimes I feel like they must be a group of Baptists, because if you put two natural law guys in the same room, you come out with three opinions on what, and I've seen that in this conference, what is natural law, what, you know, what is the unified perspective? You get different emphases, and there seems to be a lot of current debate within the tradition itself as to what it is and how it functions and how it does or does not comport with divine revelation. And so, as a follow-up to that, it seems to that there's, I also worry that there seem to be a growing number of public intellectuals and pundits that are wary of the close connection between leading proponents of natural law and their close ties to faith traditions. Now, this does not mean these arguments are not rational and that they cannot be compelling. I mean, Dr. George gave a wonderful testimony to how Nat Hentoff's idea about abortion had been affected by these kinds of public reasons. And indeed, you can get quarter with some folks. And I a couple of months ago, I was in a context with my friend Doug Baker, and I sort of likened it to this, and I'm doing this for the kids, people. This is all for the children. I sort of likened it to, you know, the scene in Episode 4, A New Hope, in Star Wars, where sometimes the Jedi mind trick works, right? So when Obi-Wan Kenobi and Luke Skywalker and 3PO and R2-D2 are, you know, gliding into Mos Eisley on their speeder, they come up to the stormtroopers. And what does Obi-Wan Kenobi do? He says, "These are not the droids that you're looking for." He states a proposition, and the stormtrooper says, "These are not the droids we're looking for. We're free to move along, go about our business."
Move along.
You know, so sometimes that works. And you can get on your Millennium Falcon and, you know, go to light speed. At other times, you're going to run into Jabba the Hutt. And, you know, you're going to try your Jedi mind trick. Captain Solo and the Wookiee will be coming with me.
Jedi mind trick.
Well, here's Jabba the Hutt. Have any of you read Steven Pinker's essay in the New Republic last fall on his reaction to President Bush's Council on Bioethics and its magnificent, let me underscore that, magnificent report on human dignity? He says the following: "Though Bioethics Council Chair Leon Cass has jawboned his version of bioethics into government deliberation and policy, it is not just a personal obsession of his, but part of a larger movement, one that is increasingly associated with Catholic institutions. In 2005, Cass relinquished the council chairmanship to Ed Pellegrino, and the 85-year-old medical ethicist and former president of the Catholic University of America. Everyone knows about the Bush administration's alliance with evangelical Protestantism, but the pervasive Catholic flavoring of the council, particularly as expressed in its dignity report, is at first glance puzzling. In fact, it is part of a powerful but little-known development in American politics, recently documented by Damon Linker in his book, The Theocons. Since episodes of divine revelation have seemed to decrease in recent millennia, the problem becomes who will formulate and interpret these standards. Most of today's denominations are not up to the task. Evangelical Protestants are too anti-intellectual, and mainstream Protestants and Judaism are too humanistic. The Catholic Church, however, with its long tradition of scholarship and its rock-solid moral precepts, became the natural home for this movement, and the journal First Things, under the leadership of Father Richard John Newhouse, its mouthpiece. Catholicism now provides the intellectual muscle behind a movement that embraces socially conservative Jewish and Protestant intellectuals as well. When Newhouse met with Bush in 1998, as he was planning his run for the presidency, they immediately hit it off. Three of the original council members, including Cass, are board members of First Things, and Newhouse himself has contributed an essay to the Dignity volume. In addition, five other members have contributed articles to First Things over the years. The concept of dignity is natural ground on which to build an obstructionist bioethics. An alleged breach of dignity provides a way for third parties to pass judgment on actions that are knowingly and willingly chosen by the affected individuals. It thus offers a moralistic justification for expanded government regulation of science, medicine, and private life, and the church's franchise to guide people in the most profound events of their lives. Birth, death, and reproduction is in danger of being undermined when bioethics scrambles the rules. It is not surprising, then, that dignity is a recurring theme in Catholic doctrine. The word appears more than 100 times in the 1997 Catechism and is a leitmotif in the Vatican's recent pronouncements on biomedicine. Now, Pinker's assessment is interesting, not because it's right. It's boorish, and it's not even insightful. But it's interesting because of its gamesmanship. Try as you might to explain to an audience that really what I'm doing is from a neutral position, they may not buy it. Guilt by association it may be, but it's a logical fallacy, but that's the world in which we live. The third concern that I have is that sometimes we can talk about arguments from reason, and they may or may not recognize the level to which people make their belief systems up, and they even discover reason through their passions, through what Michael Pogliani called personal knowledge. People begin with passions and pre-theoretical faith commitments, and this is who we are, and we have to acknowledge that. The doctrine of personal knowledge is an explanatory filter for how we should cast our public policy. Now, these reservations that I have been deep-seated in me for a long time, but I have begun to see a turn in the fortunes of these debates between theologies of revelation and the proponents of natural law. And what I want to say today is stating up front these misgivings, we must have all hands on deck and begin to work with each other. And I'm beginning to see helpful signs of how these concerns that I've mentioned are beginning to be addressed. In December, I read a review by John Wilson in the National Review. John Wilson is the founding editor of the great periodical Books and Culture, in which he had read Michael Novak's book, No One Sees God. And I really thought Wilson had Michael Novak's number. Michael Novak spends the first half of his book doing natural theology, talking about why the new atheists and their claims for atheism are wrong. And so Wilson reviewed the book and examined what he considered to be a certain number of muddles in Novak's line of thinking. And he said, on the one hand, Novak forcefully counters proponents of the new atheism by defending the rationality of and power of traditional rational proofs for God's existence. But on the other hand, later in the book, Novak concludes that, quote, neither the atheist nor the atheist or the believer sees God. Neither the atheist nor the believer sees God. Both must live in darkness. I thought, oh, well, Wilson has Novak's number. But Novak wrote a wonderful reply to Wilson in the letters to the editor in the next issue of National Review. And it was so epistemologically honest that my heart began to warm toward natural theology, which is the first time ever. And here's what he did. He said with remarkable candor that even though we might admit the rational validity of an argument, there is another universe left to explore, that of the heart. What Novak calls in his book the dark knowledge of the cloud of unknowing. He spoke movingly about his own mother who believed in God and yet suffered through her pilgrimage with God, felt like God was not there at times. We saw this in some of the journals that Mother Teresa herself had kept. It was a very Pascalian approach to the issue. The heart has its reasons, which reason cannot comprehend. I found that to be a helpful sign. And then I read this wonderful essay by J. Budziszewski in First Things called Natural Law Revealed, trying to look for ways in which revelation affirms the natural law and how these, it was, for me, being somebody that loves the church scholar fathers, it was a new doctrine of perichoresis when it comes to natural law and revelation. These two things interpenetrate one another. Nothing could restore the fortunes of historic Christianity more in postmodern times than a unified thesis of public reasons grounded in public reasons for traditional morality, complemented by an authentic recognition that there is an existential reason why people disagree with us on the basis of their own biographies and struggles that they have in their private lives. Yes, the world is cynical of us. They distrust us. But the church, I want to say to my students here especially, the church has been here before. In the wake of the Second World War and the trial of the Holocaust, the world knew what was to be true, that the church had acted too little and too late. And while we celebrate Karl Barth and Dietrich Bonhoeffer and the Pastors Emergency League and what they did in the Barman Declaration, the reality is that the German Lutheran Church opened Adolf Hitler with open arms. And there are good reasons why non-believers do not trust the church after those kinds of stumbles. The only exception to the rule, by the way, and let me just say this, is that the only people that protested Hitler were the Catholic territories in Germany. And this state of affairs was not lost on Dietrich Bonhoeffer himself. He commented to his friend Eberhard Bethge about the culture now thrust upon the West in a statement that birthed all kinds of reactions, both helpful and not so helpful. "We are now moving into a completely religionless time," Bonhoeffer said. "People as they are now simply cannot be religious anymore. The traditional structures and hierarchies of the church had failed to stop the genocide." And so writing from his prison cell at the Tegel prison, he said this, and is one of my favorite Bonhoeffer quotes, "We have grown up with the experience of our parents and our grandparents that a man can and must plan, develop, and shape his own life, and that life has a purpose about which a man must make up his own mind, and which he must then pursue with all of his strength. But we have learned by experience that we cannot even plan for the coming day, that what we have built up is being destroyed overnight, and that our life, in contrast to that of our parents, has become formless or even fragmentary. In spite of that, I can only say that I have no wish to live in any other time than our own, even though it is so inconsiderate of our outward well-being. We realize more clearly than formerly that the world lies under the wrath and grace of God. We read in Jeremiah 45, 'Thus says the Lord, behold, what I have built up, I am breaking down, and what I have planted, I am plucking up. And do you seek great things for yourself? Seek them not. For behold, I am bringing evil upon all flesh. But I will give your life as a prize of war in all of the places that you may go.' If we can save our souls unscathed out of our wreckage of material possessions, let us be satisfied with that. If the Creator destroys his own handiwork, what right have we to lament the destruction of ours? It will be the task of our generation not to seek great things, but to save and preserve our souls out of the chaos, and to carry and to realize that it is the only thing that we can carry as a prize from the burning building. Keep your heart with all diligence, for from it flows the spring of life." Bonhoeffer later says in Letters and Papers from Prison, "The church should not stand at the boundaries of culture where human powers give out. The church should be located in the village, in the heart of the village, not where human powers give out. We must be a generation not to seek great things for ourselves, but to be the kind of prophetic witness that Bonhoeffer was." This is no quietism. Bonhoeffer doesn't shut up. He protests all the way to the point that he goes to the gallows. But he instructs those who follow him, "Seek the good of the village, the health, the communities. Stand up for what is right. Be prophetic in your voice to the culture. And let us not forget that this was the way that a small, imperially persecuted, ragtag group of Christians literally set the whole Roman Empire on its ear in the 2nd, 3rd, and 4th centuries. No one decried the brutality of the Roman gladiatorial games. No one spoke out against infanticide. No one protested the treatment of women in the ancient world like the early church did. And when great, as Rodney Stark shows in several of his works, but the most notable being The Rise of Christianity, when there were cities like Antioch in which plagues and famine and racial unrest broke out, and when the plagues broke out, the rich and the elites of the culture and those who had cultural power, the muckety-mucks and the blue bloods and the well-to-dos fled to the hills to avoid the plague. It was the Christians who stayed behind. And people over time said, maybe there is something to this truth, that the Word was made flesh and dwelt among us. And so when the blue bloods and the muckety-mucks and the elites came back, they had a Christian city on their hands. Because the disease, those who could not defend themselves, were now speaking up on behalf of Jesus. If it is the case, as Goethe said, that the opinions of the young people under 25 is the destiny of any nation, we pray that young evangelicals would not be so much concerned with the fact that they don't like us anymore, but the fact that we find ourselves in a position like Bonhoeffer in the early church, where what is required for us is to be in the city for the city, bearing witness and speaking the truth to power and being the moral conscience of the culture in which we live. Thank you very much.